And support. All you need is a passion for worker justice and a desire to amplify the voices of working people. To learn more, contact Volunteer Coordinator Adrienne Rainey at 608-321-9583 or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out an application. Labor Radio, a voice for workers.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. A UN report says Russia has created a stifling climate of fear in occupied areas of Ukraine since its invasion 2 years ago. The report from the UN Human Rights Office warns of profound long-term damage to communities in eastern Ukraine. This report from Imogen Folks.
In Russian-occupied Ukraine, schools have changed to a Russian curriculum. Courts now use Russian law. All media now comes from Russia. Civilians who refuse Russian citizenship risk losing jobs, pensions and health care. But the report is also critical of Ukraine's actions in areas it has now liberated. It suggests the victims of this conflict will need not only accountability for war crimes, but a process of truth and reconciliation.
Thousands of Polish farmers are holding a nationwide protest against rising costs and competition from cheap agricultural produce from Ukraine. They're using tractors to block major roads in up to 600 locations across the country. Ongoing blockades of border crossings, particularly with Ukraine, are continuing. Tadeusz Kileta is one of the protest organisers.
The changes to the Green Deal the European Commission is proposing are purely cosmetic and will leave everybody dissatisfied. We want more specific changes. And we feel anxious about the comments from the Prime Minister who suggested that our protests might be controlled or inspired by someone else. This is simply untrue.
The Prime Minister Donald Tusk had earlier criticised some of the farmers for carrying pro-Russian banners. Meanwhile, the EU and member states have agreed to extend duty-free imports of Ukrainian produce, which have been a lifeline for its economy. But in an apparent attempt to ease concerns from European farmers about their prices being undercut, caps have been brought in on some Ukrainian items, including oats, eggs, poultry and sugar. The extension by a year has been welcomed by Kyiv. Brussels is said to be considering imposing heavy tariffs on cereals from Russia and Belarus. The Israeli army says it's continuing what it calls precise operations in the area around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. Palestinian media say Israeli airstrikes killed dozens of people overnight, including at least 23 organising security for aid delivery. Here's Anna Foster.
The IDF say that they killed around 90 gunmen and arrested 160 in that raid on Al-Shifa Hospital. A statement says over the past day, the troops have eliminated terrorists and located weapons in the hospital area, while preventing harm to civilians, patients, medical teams and medical equipment. Now, there has been condemnation of that operation because it obviously focused on a hospital. Hamas said that Israel had violated international law because, of course, hospitals are supposed to be protected.
World News from the BBC.
Hi, my name is Vicky Kenyon. I'm your host for this week's Access Hour on WORT Madison, and I am a connector. I have always loved connecting people with one another and connecting people to resources. As I dove into my second career as a realtor, I found that much of the queer and trans community on a national level is not connecting to home ownership in ways that the rest of our country does. I want to change that. My aim is to make a significant positive impact on queer and trans home ownership here in Dane County. So, after a lot of networking and a lot of planning, I gathered a team of four other professionals and launched a free educational series that provides resources and answers to questions around home ownership in an inclusive, welcoming, and safe space. And now, we bring our knowledge to you here. On this week's Access Hour, my team and I will be here talking Home Ownership 101 and answering your questions live.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flicks Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
The WORT Board of Directors will hold its regularly scheduled meeting on Wednesday, March 20th at 7 p.m. virtually via Zoom. The public is welcome to attend. For instructions on how to attend this meeting, email president@wortfm.org.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, March 20th, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Tess Romansky. And Tess Romansky is a communications and development manager at Fair Share CSA Coalition. So Fair Share CSA Coalition's mission is to support and connect farmers and eaters through community-supported agriculture. And they envision a future where CSA is the backbone of a strong local food system where all families have access to locally produced organic food from small-scale farmers. And the Fair Share CSA Coalition is a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. So stay tuned to hear from Tess Romansky. Also, a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies found that 35 major U.S. corporations paid less in federal income taxes between 2018 and 2022 than they paid their top five executives. So among those 35 corporations, their total executive compensation over the five-year time span was $9.5 billion, where their combined federal income tax bills came to a negative $1.8 billion. So yes, that means that they received refunds totaling that amount. So I'll be speaking with Will Rice, senior writer at Americans for Tax Fairness and co-author of that report. I mean, then later from Democracy Now!, the Democracy Now! Column, Haiti, Honduras, and American hegemony. So stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back.
Forever, my darling, our love will be true. Always and forever, I'll love only you. Just promise me, darling, your love in return. May this fire in my soul, dear, forever burn. My heart's at your commanding to keep love and to hold. Making you happy is my desire, dear. Keeping you is my goal. I'll forever love you for the rest of my days. I'll never part from you and your loving ways. Mm-hmm. trying to hold. Making you happy is my desire, dear. Keeping you is my goal. I'll forever love you for the rest of my days. I'll never part from you and your loving ways. Ooh, ooh, ooh. If you want something to play with, go and find yourself a toy. 'Cause baby, my time is too expensive, and I'm not a little boy. Oh, oh, oh. You are serious. Don't play with my heart, it makes me furious. Oh, but if you want me to love you, then baby, I'm a wiggle. Girl, you know that I'm wiggle. Mama, tell it like it is. Don't be ashamed, let your conscience be your guide. Well, I know that deep down inside of me, oh, I believe. I believe you love me. Forget your foolish pride. Oh. You know life is too short to have sorrow. Yeah, 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 yeah. You may be here today and gone tomorrow. So you might as well get what you want. So go on and live, baby. Go on and live. Tell it like it is. I'm nothing to play with it. Girl, you better find yourself a toy. Deep down inside of me, oh, I believe you love me, but I'm not your little boy. Oh, believe me, oh, believe me. Oh, 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 oh. Tell it like it is. Oh, I love you, oh, I love you, oh, I love you. Oh, I love you, my dog, my dog. There is nothing I can do about it. Hey, 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 hey.
Hey,
That was beautiful music, and I was enjoying that. But I am glad that we've got Tess Romansky with me. And Tess Romansky is the Communications and Development Manager at FairShare CSA Coalition. And FairShare CSA Coalition's mission is to support and connect farmers and eaters through community-supported agriculture. They envision a future where CSA is the backbone of a strong local food system where all families have access to locally produced organic food from small-scale farms. And they are a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. So, hey, good morning, Tess Romansky. Glad to have you on. I think we'll just give it a try to reconnect. And yeah, let's hear more music. We'll go with music. I have something else in mind if we don't reach her.
Earth angel, will you be mine? My darling dear, love you all the time. I'm just a fool in love with you. Earth angel, earth angel.
Hey, Tess Romansky, glad to have you on WORT. Tess Romansky is the Communications and Development Manager at the FairShare CSA Coalition. Good morning, Tess.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm glad. I'm so glad that we've got you. I want to let listeners know that the FairShare CSA Coalition is a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. Tess, for folks who may not know what CSA is, let's start there those that are kind of newbies to CSA.
Absolutely, yeah. CSA stands for Community Supported Agriculture. There's a lot of different ways that looks, but essentially, the main crux of CSA is a direct relationship between a farmer and an eater. And so the basics of CSA are someone finds a farm, they're really interested in it. They pay upfront at the beginning of the season, so they essentially buy into the farm with an upfront cost. And then throughout the season, the farmer then gives them a share of that produce. So you're kind of supporting the farm. You know, CSA sign-up season is right now, so farmers are buying seeds, they're buying compost, they're getting ready for the season. When CSA members buy into the farm, that's helping the farmer kind of kickstart their season. And then throughout the season, as that bounty is harvested in the field, their members are able to receive that from the farm. So it's a direct connection between your farmer and, there's a lot of different ways that can look. So there's the traditional box CSA where you pay up front at the beginning of the year and every week your farmer drops a box of food off for you. And then over time, as things have evolved, there's been some more advances in the model where there's customizable CSAs. So one of the great things with technology is, some farms offer swaps where you can kind of pick and choose from what's in season and make your own box. There's also market shares where you buy upfront at the beginning of the season, and then each week you go and essentially shop for your share at your farmer's booth at the farmer's market or on the farm. A lot of our farms also do on-farm pickup, so you get to go to the farm and kind of pick your produce from whatever they have available. There's just a lot of really great flexibilities and customizations within the CSA model that we've seen in recent years. So yeah, that's kind of the basics of CSA. Each CSA farm does things a little differently. So keeping it broad to not exclude folks who do things a certain way. But in general, yeah, pay up front and then you get a wide variety of fruits and vegetables directly from your farmer throughout the season.
So I want to come back to that in a second about exactly how that works and how people can participate. But what does then the coalition do, the FairShare CSA coalition do, and what are your sort of core program areas?
Yeah, so FairShare CSA coalition, we have both consumer outreach and farm support. So there's kind of two prongs to the work we do. one aspect of it is CSA education and outreach, so explaining what CSA is and then connecting folks to farmers in our coalition. And then the farmer support side is really focused around listening to what the needs of small-scale organic diversified vegetable farmers in Wisconsin and across the Midwest are, and then providing support and training and programming to make sure that those farms can succeed and can thrive and are viable. So that looks like we have, you know, labor on the farm is something that a lot of our farmers have been coming up and saying, you know, we're having trouble finding and keeping labor. And so we've introduced several labor management training series and an apprenticeship program to kind of help provide farmers with the resources they need to become great employers. We have a lot of grower gatherings and field days focused on climate change mitigation. You know, as the climate is changing, there's a lot of things happening that make farming harder. And so just kind of trying to provide that ground level support for the farmers in our coalition to make sure that they can thrive and do the things that they do best. So those are kind of the two main things, obviously, with the underlying core being connecting people to local fresh food and supporting small scale farmers.
And can you put it even in the larger context about food production and the whole CSA movement and why it's important to support CSA farmers?
Yeah. So I think, you know, there's a lot of amazing things that our small scale farmers are doing. One of the biggest things is the farms in our coalition are so focused on environmental sustainability and, you know, nourishing the ground and, nourishing our bodies while also nourishing the ground rather than depleting it. And so CSA is great because it's very diversified. It's not 500 acres of one crop. It's 500 different vegetable varieties on 5 acres sometimes. So there's a lot of diversity, a lot of biodiversity, and then also a lot of just really intentional management of the ground and of our water systems. There's a lot less packaging. So from an environmental perspective, CSA is just a really great way to know that your food is being produced with care and without depleting our natural resources. And then also from an economic perspective, you know, small scale farms are so critical to our local economies. And so CSA is great because you're paying your farmer directly and they are putting that money back into their community. And so there's not necessarily all of these middle steps of, you know, you go to a big box grocery store and they bought it from a distributor who bought it from a farm and it's being transported hundreds of miles. It's like, literally, you can go to your farm and buy your food from someone you know who lives in your community. So it's a very direct relationship, and also, really supporting kind of those small scale local economies that make our communities thrive.
So the Fair Share CSA Coalition is, you know, working to make this more affordable too. Is that correct?
Yes. Yep. So we have what's called our Partner Shares program, which applications are currently still being accepted. And essentially, we provide cost assistance to folks who would like to purchase CSA, but maybe don't necessarily have it in their budget. So we provide 25% to 75% of assistance. So far, folks who participate in the program are still paying a little bit of that cost, but we are also able to subsidize that, you know, that cost to make it fit within their budget. And within that program, we're also able to accept SNAP EBT, so people can use their food benefits to help pay for that fresh produce. And it's a really great way because it allows people to kind of to choose what food they're getting and also what fits with their budget. So it's really flexible. It's really empowering for people. It is a food access program that's really focused on connecting people most directly. So, you know, we provide some of that assistance, but it's really helping people just directly get to their farmer and get the food that they need.
So that financial support is through the Partner Shares program. Are any of the farmers able to take food share?
It depends on the farm. I don't know if I can speak to how many of our farmers can specifically take that. I will also add just that so a lot of our farms also have their own assistance program as well. So a lot of our farms fundraise and help do some of that offset. Some of our farms offer a sliding scale subscription model, just straight up. So, you know, some people pay more, other people pay less. Some farms just do direct fundraising to offer shares for free to different community members. So there's a lot of different ways that
Sounds good.
Hey, we as a group are working it. Yeah.
Sounds good. You know, the idea of having somebody deliver the vegetables sounds so nice to me. It seems nostalgic, but it does make sense to kind of go out to the farm. How far away are your farms from, say, the Madison area?
Yeah, we have, we have about 40 endorsed farms in our coalition, but about 20 to 25 serve the Madison area. Not all of them are in the Madison area, obviously. There are a few that are, you know, within 10 miles and then some a little bit further away. I will say that not every farm is a pickup site. So some farms, actually the majority of our farms, will coordinate with a local business or a local homeowner and will drop like 20 shares off at a business at a specific time, and folks will go to that business or to that member's house. So you can, there are farms that offer on-farm pickup close to the Madison area. Blue Moon Community Farm is one that comes to mind right away. She's right outside Stoughton. And so people can just kind of go. It's like a, depending on where you are in Madison, it's about a 15 or 20 minute drive. You go out to the farm, you pick it up, and it's lovely. Other farms are coming in from like the Driftless region and will coordinate with someone to kind of house all the shares. So they'll Tuesday afternoon, they're going to drive in, drop their share off at this house, and then the members come to that house and pick up their share from there. So it's like a 5 minute drive for me. It's a little bit further away for the farm, but it's still kind of like a central gathering area where we all grab our food.
Tess, there was something in your bio that I thought was really interesting. You have a Master's of Food and Agriculture Law and Policy from Vermont Law School. I wanted to ask you about policy issues and if there are any legislative issues around local food production that we need to be aware of or not. Is there anything happening?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. In my current role, I don't actually do much policy work. So I'm not as attuned to that that world right now. I believe there is, there was just some food access legislation that was passed in the Senate, I believe, the GUSNET program.
That can give people a heads up if they want to look at that further. And it was a, you can't always tell by the title, but food access, it sounds like that was a good thing.
But we should. Yes. Yeah.
The, I know there's, you just had a big, organic food conference earlier in the year, and now you have some other events that people can learn more about in the fall. But with the time we have left, can you just tell us more about how to participate? Because now's the time, right? Because now they're buying their seeds, now they're planting, the farmers are.
Yes, yep. CSA season is definitely in full swing. One of the easiest ways, we have on our website a farm search tool, so you can kind of look at a lot of different options on which day you want to pick up your share, how far away you want to pick up your share, where you want to pick it up, what kind of produce you want. So that's on our website, the farm search tool, and then it's once you search for a farm, it'll kind of give you a list of the farmers in our coalition that fit those criteria, and so you can look and do your research on, you know, what farm fits for you and sign up. So that's a really easy way to do it. I know there's also lots of other resources. You can just Google search, you can go to the farmers market. The REAP Food Atlas also has CSA shares in there. But the farm search tool is a really easy interactive way to kind of search for exactly what type of farm you're looking for, find a farm and sign up. And signing up with a farm, you know, I think almost all, if not all of our farms, just have an online application form where you just can fill it out right online, and then you're set for the season.
You know, it's I'm sort of disoriented because it was so warm a couple of weeks ago that I was outside turning over soil. But what's the window of time before, you know, folks have already determined what they're going to be planting this season?
Yeah, well, I think most of our farmers spend most of the winter months kind of figuring out what they're planting and when things are going in the ground. A lot of our farms have greenhouses, so that's nice. Okay. With this changing weather, they can kind of get things started, and then depending on the weather, either open it up or shut things down if it gets cold again like it's supposed to. But yeah, seeds are definitely in the ground. They're getting started.
People can buy a share early, later. Is there like a cutoff point?
So spring shares will start in April, and then the kind of the main CSA season for most of our farms is May. So now through, you know, late April is kind of when things are still open. And then kind of starting in May, things are set, and then some farms offer winter shares that open up in the fall.
So Tess Romanski is Communications and Development Manager at FairShare CSA Coalition. Tess, if people want more information, what's the best way to reach you?
Yeah, my email is tess@csacoalition.org, and then our website is just csacoalition.org.
If you're a farmer or an eater, you can contact us. And the FairShare CSA Coalition is a member agency of Community Shares of Wisconsin. Hey, thanks to have you on this morning, Tess. It was great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Hey, it's 8:32, and standing by is Will Rice. So we're going to just take a little bit of a music break and then I'll catch up with him. So thank you for standing by, Will Rice. Hey, a new report from Americans for Tax Fairness and the Institute for Policy Studies found that 35 major U.S. corporations paid less in federal income taxes between 2018 and 2022 than they paid their top five executives. So among those 35 corporations, their total executive compensation over the five-year time span was $9.5 billion, while their combined federal income tax bills came to negative $1.8 billion. So yes, that means they received refunds totaling that amount. So joining me is Will Rice. Will Rice is senior writer at Americans for Tax Fairness and is co-author of the report. So hey, thank you, Will Rice, for joining me. Thanks for standing by.
Thank you so much for having me.
You say it's important that people know this, that in fact, folks are pretty busy. You know, they have a idea that somehow the system is rigged against them. But this report and your analysis of a larger report by the, I think it's the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, gives us really concrete examples of this unfairness.
Yeah, and what we're trying to point out in our report is that there's two bad trends going on. One is that big profitable corporations are paying less and less in taxes in terms of a share of the national economy. And meanwhile, their top executives are raking in larger and larger amounts of compensation. And both those trends are bad news for America's working families, because it means on the one hand, there's less money available for public services. On the other, there's less money available in these corporations to pay ordinary workers and also to make the kind of investments that make a corporation profitable and sound in the long term.
So tell us some of the key findings of your report.
Well, you hit on some of them. I think the most striking one is that there were 35 major U.S. corporations, and these include familiar names like Ford, Netflix, T-Mobile, and Tesla, paid less in federal income taxes between 2018 and 2022 than they paid their top five executives. And all 35 of those companies were cumulatively profitable over that five-year period. It's also notable that 18 corporations in our study, despite reporting net profits over that those five years, paid zero or in almost every case less than zero. They got refunds over that over those five periods, despite over $5 billion, despite being profitable and somehow finding the money to pay their executives over $5 billion. So what we're trying to point out here is that corporations that are able to legally avoid paying their taxes actually have plenty of money, and a lot of that money winds up in the pockets of their top executives. And this is for a lot of reasons. There's been a general trend for the last 40 years of demanding less of our big corporations in terms of contributing to our national government through taxation, while at the same time there have been trends expanding the ratio between what top executives are paid and what ordinary workers are paid from roughly 20 to 1 50 years ago to now over 300 to 1 is the ratio of CEO pay to median worker pay at these large corporations.
You know, and an additional parenthetical from the Institute for Policy Studies that we've been hearing about is it also is accounting for a larger proportion of what we think of as inflation, which is really due to these kinds of profits and corporate pay and not so much the cost of production. So it's hurting us everywhere. Tell us more about what you found. And I want to you know, talk about that and then get to solutions.
Okay. Well, other key points from the report are that the reason corporate tax payments are so low now is a combination of the official tax rate that corporations are supposed to pay, what's called the statutory rate, has declined by 3/5 over the last 70 years or so, and by 2/5 just in the last 7 years. There was a big corporate tax rate cut under President Trump and with the assistance of a Republican Congress back in 2017. The corporate tax rate was cut by 2/5, and predictably, corporate tax receipts fell. In addition to where the official corporate tax rate is, corporations can use loopholes and special breaks to whittle down their tax payments even further. And one of the most destructive forms of corporate tax dodging is the offshoring of profits and sometimes even jobs in order to cut down on their U.S. tax obligations. And then on the side of executive pay, even though there have been some efforts to curb that, the impetus is just too strong to have these corporate executive pay packages continue to skyrocket. One of the reasons for that is that corporate boards are often stocked with executives from other companies, so they're kind of log rolling. They're each promoting big pay packages for their fellow CEOs. And the disadvantage of that, in addition to just spending all that money, is that a lot of their compensation comes in the form of stock, whether direct stock or options to buy stock at a preferable price. And so they have a strong inclination to try to juice the share price of their corporation, even if that's not in the best long-term interests of the corporation, the people who work for it, and the communities those corporations are in.
And so I just want to, so there was reason to look specifically at the 5 years after the Trump tax cuts, when it dropped from 35% to 21%, this problem, though, long brewing. And that even if it's at 21%, these corporations were paying, getting refunds, zero or maybe 1 or 2% taxes actually, right?
That's right. The real problem there is that corporations are essentially allowed to figure their profitability in two different ways. When they're trying to attract investors on Wall Street, they use a certain metric of profitability that makes their profitability, that makes their profits look bigger. And when they're figuring out what they owe the IRS, they're allowed to use a different system that makes it look much, much smaller. So It would seem that if a corporation was profitable, they should be paying taxes. They should be paying taxes at a fairly good rate. But because of these two different systems, they announce that they're profitable to Wall Street, which is the more accurate metric, really. But at the same time, they're poor-mouthing the IRS and saying we can't afford to pay any taxes. And in fact, we need some money back because of a loss maybe we had 4 years ago. So President Biden, and actually you're going to talk about solutions, that one thing he's tried to do, actually accomplished in the Inflation Reduction Act a couple of years ago, was for the very largest corporations, the ones worth over $1 billion, who have more than $1 billion in profits, he's requiring them to pay at least 15% based on what the profit figure they report to Wall Street, what's called book income. And that's only starting to be implemented, but that's certainly a step in the right direction.
Now, you mentioned Netflix and Ford. Can you give us more examples? You have the terrible 10 case studies.
Yeah. The topping it off is Tesla, whose CEO is depending on where the stock market is today, either one of the or the most wealthiest man in the world, Elon Musk. pardon me. he got a tax package. It was so big that Delaware, where most American corporations are incorporated because it's so business friendly, a judge in Delaware struck it down as excessive. It was worth, at this point, at the time of the lawsuit, $56 billion. So Tesla may have to revise that figure, but whatever it is they wind up paying him, it'll be more than they're paying in taxes. A big reason for Tesla not paying much in taxes is that they were losing money for a long time, and you only have to pay taxes if you're profitable. But it's clear from a lot of the maneuvers they're using that even as they become profitable, which they have been over the last few years, they're going to be one of those companies that takes every possible legal maneuver to avoid paying their fair share. T-Mobile is another example. They paid their executives $675 million over those 5 years, their top five executives, and paid less than zero, got an $80 million refund over those 5 years. And T-Mobile is an example where they're drawing a lot on the public resources. They were able to buy up spectrum for their wireless services, and were given tax breaks in the process. Netflix, which a lot of us subscribe to, $652 million in executive pay, paid a federal income tax rate of 1.6% on over $15 billion in profits. And the average American household pays about 15% in taxes every year.
And they just raised their rates too, but they made $15 billion. Just have to throw that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you mentioned what's called greedflation before. There was definitely, right after the pandemic, there were problems with supply chains and build up demand, enough stuff that led to inflation. But there's good studies showing that now corporations are just using it as an excuse and just prying more money out of people.
You know, when you looked at this data, you know, what kind of companies were getting the largest deals, packages? Did you take a look at that?
Well, the one trend in terms of industries that we found was that energy companies were particularly persistent tax dodgers. And the reason for that is that there's a particular dodge called accelerated depreciation that utilities can use. And what depreciation is an accounting term that means that you're supposed to spread out the cost of something. Like if you build a building or buy a large piece of equipment, you're supposed to write off the cost of that over the useful lifespan of the piece of equipment. But currently, during those 5 years, corporations could just write off immediately the full cost of something, even if it didn't without taking into account the fact that it would be useful for them for sometimes decades. So energy companies have large capital investments, and they were able to use that to really take down their the costs their tax payments.
So you're a tax writer at Americans for Tax Fairness, and I appreciate how understandable this report is. And in terms of the takeaways that really need to be out there, you know, do you how well are we doing at getting this information out there? I'm not, you guys are doing a good job, but just into the mainstream. So the problem, and then how well are we doing that? And then let's just wind up with more solutions.
Okay. Well, the problem with taxes as a issue is that it's math, which a lot of people don't like. It's complicated. It can seem complicated. And people generally are a little frightened by the IRS. So, but that's a useful screen behind which corporations and wealthy people can get away with a lot of mischief. So I appreciate this opportunity to talk to you. And I guess the message you want to get out is taxes can be a complicated issue, but the basic principles are not that complicated. And most people in America have a sense, even if they don't know all the details, that there's something wrong, that there's something rigged about the system. So we encourage people to just learn as much as they need to, which isn't an awful lot, to be a champion for tax fairness and to make that an important question they ask candidates and that they educate themselves on when they're voting. Apologize, I'm getting over a cold. But in terms of solutions, we lay out some of them at the end of the report. And the simplest one in terms of the low level of corporate tax payments is to raise the corporate tax rate. As you mentioned, it used to be 35%, although no one really paid that much usually. But President Trump and the Republicans lowered to 21%. President Biden has proposed raising it back up to 28%, which would just be halfway back to where it was before. And if we just did that, according to the Congressional Budget scorekeepers, we could raise over $1 trillion in revenue over the next 10 years, money that we could be used to lower the cost of health care, to provide better child care, to improve education, to make housing more affordable. So that's a simple step. And then there are bills in Congress to try to curb the ability of corporations to dodge their taxes by shifting profits and production offshore. And then there are also a lot of proposals to try to rein in excessive executive pay. So the answers are out there. The proposals are in Congress. We just need the right people there to vote on them and to get them enacted.
You know, you mentioned, I think, enforcement or alluded to it. What about enforcement? The average taxpayer is afraid of the IRS. Why aren't they?
Well, because the average taxpayer doesn't have an army of accountants and tax lawyers. Yes, I mean, and that's another thing that the Biden administration actually has accomplished in that same law, the Inflation Reduction Act, 2 years ago. For the previous 10 or 15 years, the IRS had been the target of a purposeful effort to basically make it too weak to go after big targets who were blatantly evading taxes. And this is now illegal tax evasion we're talking about. And so 2 years ago, President Biden and the Democrats in Congress passed a law that gave the IRS, that basically restored its funding to what it should have been. And they're already going after billionaires and large corporations. And that's going to raise lots of money. It's going to lower the deficit and create more money again for useful public services. Republicans have been going after that restored funding tooth and nail. They actually achieved a $20 billion reduction in it. But we're hopeful that the Democrats will hold the line there and the IRS can be restored to its full strength and actually make sure everyone obeys the law and we can crack down on rich tax cheats. And they're not going to use the money to go after anyone who makes less than $400,000 a year.
So are any of the proposals bipartisan?
I wish I could say yes, but Republican ideology is basically hamstrung on this idea that they never should. No wealthy person or corporation should ever be asked to pay a nickel more in taxes. And I think that's short-sighted and is counter to what most people want. In fact, what most Republican voters want. Polling shows over and over again that all across the political spectrum, Americans want rich people and corporations to pay a fair share of tax. So the politicians representing them are not doing a good job, but instead are just responding to the demands of their donors, I think.
Right. You know, folks, look for this. You can link to the report through the Institute for Policy Studies or the Institute for Public Accuracy, and look at the report. You can also, from that, link into the larger Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. The report's called Corporate Tax Avoidance in the First 5 Years of the Trump Tax Law. The Will Rice is a senior writer at Americans for Tax Fairness, and along with the Institute for Policy Studies, is co-author of this report. I have just so many questions. I'm out of time, Will Rice, but you know, this isn't out there. There's so much misdirection and lies out there, right? So we got to cut through all of that. PR.
Yeah, there's a big fight coming up over the next couple of years because a lot of the parts of the Trump GOP tax law are actually expiring as an accounting maneuver. Basically, they make some components of their law temporary. They're going to expire at the end of next year, and there's going to be a big fight over whether they should be allowed to expire for people who are very wealthy, as President Biden wants, or they're going to continue them all at a cost of trillions of dollars. So that's something for people to try to maybe key into. The position of President Biden and the Democrats is to try to keep the lower taxes for ordinary people making less than $400,000 a year, but let the tax cuts for those who are wealthier expire.
Hey, thank you. I'm speaking with Will Rice, senior writer for Americans for Tax Fairness. And you just log on to their website, Americans for Tax Fairness, and you'll just get a whole lot of really useful information. You know, reporters need to be asking these questions too, I think, and I'm not hearing them asking that when they are within the candidates or Trump's ear. Thank you, Will. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much.
And it's 8:53. We're going to turn to Democracy Now! On the Democracy Now! Column, Haiti, Honduras, and American hegemony. So are we ready for that, Dave? Here we go.
Haiti, Honduras, and U.S. hegemony. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Haiti and Honduras have made headlines in the last few weeks. Honduras's former president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, was just convicted in a U.S. court of drug trafficking. He faces life in prison. Haiti's a nation without a government, as armed groups have united against the U.S.-backed unelected prime minister installed after the assassination of their president in 2021. In both cases, what's missing from mainstream news coverage is the role of U.S. intervention that brought them to this point.
The crisis in Haiti is a crisis of imperialism.
University of British Columbia professor Jemima Pierre, a Haitian-American scholar, explained on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. In her NACLA Report article headlined Haiti as Empire's Laboratory, she describes her home country as, quote, the site of the longest and most brutal neocolonial experiment in the modern world, unquote. Haiti was the world's first black republic, founded in 1804 following a slave revolt. France demanded Haiti pay reparations for the loss of slave labor when Haiti's enslaved people freed themselves. For more than a century, Haiti's debt payments to France, then later to the U.S., hobbled its economy. The United States refused to recognize Haiti for decades until 1862, fearful that the example of a slave uprising would inspire the same in the United States. In 1915, the U.S. invaded Haiti, occupying it until 1934. The U.S. also backed the brutal Duvalier dictatorships from 1957 to 1986. Jean-Bertrand Aristide became Haiti's first democratically elected president in 1991, only to be ousted in a violent coup 8 months later. The coup was supported by President George H.W. Bush and later by President Bill Clinton. Public pressure forced Clinton to allow Aristide's return in 1994 to finish his presidential term in 1996. Aristide was reelected in 2001.
In 2004, as has been revealed and admitted to, the U.S., France, and Canada got together and backed a coup d'etat against the country's first democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Jemima Pierre continued.
The U.S. Marines flew into his home, put him on a plane with his security officials, his wife, and aide, and flew them to the Central African Republic.
Democracy Now! Traveled to the Central African Republic in 2004, covering a delegation led by TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson and U.S. Congressmember Maxine Waters, who defied U.S. policy and escorted the Aristides back to the Western Hemisphere. Aristide confirmed then to Democracy Now! That he'd been ousted in a coup d'etat backed by the United States. Aristide then went to live in exile in South Africa for the next 7 years. In response to allegations that gangs are currently controlling Haiti, Professor Pierre said,
the so-called gang violence is actually not the main problem in Haiti. The main problem in Haiti is the constant interference of the international community. And the international community here is very explicitly the U.S., France, and Canada.
The Biden administration is reportedly now considering the transfer of Haitian asylum seekers to the controversial U.S. Navy base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, a repeat of some of the worst U.S. policies in its long history of exploitation of Haitians. Honduras, meanwhile, currently has a democratically elected president, Xiomara Castro. Her husband, Manuel Mel Zelaya, was elected president in 2006, then ousted in a U.S.-backed coup in 2009. In the following years, Honduras descended into a narco state, forcing hundreds of thousands to flee violence, seeking asylum in the United States and elsewhere. In 2013, Juan Orlando Hernandez was elected president amidst allegations of campaign finance violations. Then again in 2017, in an election widely considered fraudulent. Shortly thereafter, his brother, Juan Antonio Hernandez, was arrested in Miami for drug trafficking. Then, following Xiomara Castro's election, former President Juan Orlando Hernandez himself was arrested and extradited to the U.S. for cocaine trafficking. On March 8th, he was convicted in U.S. federal court and is currently awaiting sentencing.
The evidence was chilling.
History professor Dana Frank, who was in the courtroom, said on Democracy Now!,
this litany of assassinations of prosecutors, assassinations of journalists, corruption of the police, the military, politicians, the president, his brother, you name it. And it was like the curtain was drawn back and you could see the day-to-day workings of this tremendous, violent, corrupt mechanism that was the Juan Orlando Hernandez administration, but also that of Pepe Lobo, as you said, before him. And all of this was what happened after the 2009 coup that opened the door for the destruction of the rule of law in Honduras.
U.S. intervention in Haiti, Honduras, and other countries is one of the principal drivers of people seeking asylum in the United States as they flee violence, poverty, and persecution at home. This point is almost never mentioned in the U.S. press. To understand and ultimately solve the immigration crisis, Americans need to understand what their government has long done in their name with their tax dollars, arming and propping up brutal regimes abroad. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And you can hear that column again at the Democracy Now! Website because it was just chock full of a lot of information. Folks might want to hear it again. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you to Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer this morning. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I will talk with you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM, Madison. Coming up next, right after the Insurgent Radio Kiosk, back to the country, so stay tuned.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, March 20th.
Poor Katie Britt, the Republican senator from Alabama. She was set up by her party's operatives to do the GOP's televised response to Joe Biden's State of the Union speech. Sadly, her moment in the national limelight was widely panned, even by Republicans, for her presentation was overwrought and, well, cringy. But the visuals pale to insignificance when you consider that her partisan presentation was based on an intentional abject lie, exacerbated by her shameful exploitation of a woman who had been brutally raped. Britt told about a 12-year-old Mexican girl who was the victim of multiple rapes, implying the girl's horror was caused by, quote, Biden's border crisis. Unfortunately for the senator, an alert investigative reporter blew the whistle on her political lie. Yes, the grotesque rapes happened, but 20 years ago, not on Biden's watch. Indeed, Republican George W. Bush was president. Also, her nightmare occurred in central Mexico, far from the U.S. border, and it had nothing to do with migrants. Britt knew she was lying as she dramatically concluded that Biden's Latino invasion, as Republicans demagogically brand desperate refugees, is, quote, almost entirely preventable. Yes, but guess who helped negotiate a bipartisan bill to end the border crush, then cynically voted to kill the bill because Donald Trump told her to? Katie Britt. This is Jim Hightower saying, and what about that Mexican woman whose trauma Britt cruelly exploited? She's now working in Mexico for a nonprofit trying to stop human trafficking. Yet Britt and the GOP didn't even have the grace to tell her they were going to pervert her story for partisan politics. I thought it was very strange, she said when later informed of Britt's crude re-exploitation of her, adding pointedly that the work I do is not a game. The Hightower Radio Lowdown is made possible by you subscribers to Jim Hightower's Lowdown on Substack. Find us at jimhightower.substack.com.
Tonight at 6 o'clock, Dr. Nicole R. Fleetwood will speak at the UW Center for the Humanities' Nellie McKay